Okay, well, let's begin by reading Psalm 96 as our opening prayer. So if you turn to Psalm 96, I'll make a couple of comments on it before we read it. I don't know if your Bible does this or not, but mine breaks Psalm 96 into three parts, one after verse 6, one after verse 10, and then the rest of the psalm. I mentioned a few weeks ago that one of the ways to notice what a psalm is about is when there's a break in the pattern of two lines, sometimes three lines. But if you look at the end of verse 10 and then at the end of verse 13, this psalm is about, it's a praising God, and the main thing that we're praising for is at the end of verse 10, he will judge the peoples with equity or with uprightness. And then also it's repeated then at the end of verse 13, which is also kind of breaks the pattern. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in faithfulness. So the psalm is really about praising the coming righteous judge, or judge who judges righteously. And it breaks into three parts, and you can see it pretty easily. Praise God for this. Praise God because he is this, praise God because he is this, and then praise God because he is coming to judge. So we'll read through that. The first part is sing to, one way of praising, sing to the Lord because he is great. That covers the first six verses. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth. Sing to the Lord, bless his name, proclaim good tidings of his salvation from day to day. Tell of his glory among the nations, his wonderful deeds among all the peoples. And here's why. Because the Lord is great and greatly to be praised. He is to be feared above all gods, for all the gods of the people are idols, but the Lord made the heavens. Splendor and majesty are before him. Strength and beauty are in his sanctuary. In the next praise section, ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples. Ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory of his name. Bring an offering and come into his courts. Worship the Lord in the splendor of holiness, tremble before him all the earth. Say among the nations, here's why. The Lord reigns. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. And then now the last section, let the heavens be glad, and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all it contains. Let the field exult and all that is in it. Then all the trees of the forest will sing for joy. And here's why. Before the Lord, for he is coming. For he is coming to the earth to judge. He will judge the world in righteousness and the peoples in his faithfulness. Psalm 96. A psalm of praise to God for, because he is the righteous, the coming righteous judge. In this psalm, in the second section from verses 7 to 10, ascribe to the Lord, O families of the peoples, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength. Ascribe to the Lord the glory of his name. That's this section in Samuel that we're working on uses that same word glory in a number of different ways, and it's actually a good a good kind of theme or kickoff to Samuel chapters 4 and 5 that we're going to deal with today, or 5 and 6, and maybe a little bit more if we get time. So at the end of last time, we had that the Ark of the Lord, so the Ark of the Covenant, as we would refer to it normally, had been captured by the Philistines. Israel had gone into battle and got beaten badly, so they thought it would be a good idea to go get the Ark from its place, which was in Shiloh, and then bring that along, and that should help them to win the battle against the Philistines. Well, it turned out worse for them. Not only did they get beat, but they got beat badly the second time, and the Ark is actually captured at that point. And it's one of the things here that happens with the Ark in this section of 1 Samuel is, it's not like a genie in a bottle, okay? The Ark isn't like that. God's not like that. And often what people want to have happen, what they want the Lord to do because of the Ark, he does something differently. He is sovereign in that way. And so now the Philistines have the Ark. And at the very end of chapter 4, we had that one of the priests' wife, remember the priests Phinehas and Hophni were killed in the battle. Their father Eli, when he hears the news, dies. And then the wife gives birth to a son, and they name him Ichabod, which means, where is the glory? So now that the Ark has been captured, where is the glory of Israel? And chapters 5 and 6, I think they're picking up on this theme here of where is the glory, because the Ark goes different places. And because the Ark, or when the Ark goes different places would be a better way to say it, God does certain things, and not necessarily as would be expected by those who have the Ark. So let's begin with 1 Samuel chapter 5, verse 1. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Okay, Ebenezer was the place where Israel was camped for the battle. And Ashdod is a city along the Mediterranean coast, west of Jerusalem, but way over by the coast. And it is a Philistine city. It's one of the five great Philistine cities. Okay, so they're bringing it into one of their cities. And the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon. So Dagon is their god, okay? He is not a god that the Philistines brought with them when they settled this land from somewhere else. They've adopted a god of the peoples of this area. So in a broad general sense, you could say he's a Canaanite god. But the Philistines, who have settled in this area, have taken him as their god. And one of the reasons this happens is because among the ancient peoples, gods were often thought to have territories. And so this was a god who they took from the Canaanites because they were now in Canaanite territory, and they thought they could be successful by adopting one of their gods. You're familiar with the term Baal, or Baal, we say in English. But in the Canaanite idea, this is the father of Baal, or Baal. So Dagon is the god that they adopt. And they take the Ark of God and put it in the house of Dagon, or the temple of Dagon. And they set it up beside Dagon. This is a really interesting, it's an interesting phrase that is used, interesting terms that are used here. So it would have been common practice if you could get a hold of your enemy's gods to take them. But they do something a little bit strange here. They don't set up the Ark of the Covenant, who they would assume was somehow related to the God of Israel. But they don't put it in front of Dagon as you might think, to worship their God. Instead, they set the Ark up beside Dagon. So probably not as a symbol that necessarily that Dagon is responsible for capturing the Ark. Maybe, but they also, remember, they had a pretty high opinion of the God or the gods of Israel because they knew all about the Egyptian things that happened, about how the nation of Israel was freed from Egypt with great signs and great wonders, and so they had some respect for the God of Israel, and they may have been trying to adopt him as well as they moved out and to conquer Israel and more territory. So they set him up beside Dagon in their temple, and when the people of Ashdod, this is verse 3, rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of Yahweh. Now, just about everybody agrees that this what's described here is that Dagon is falling down in a position of worship. Okay, so he falls down face down before, not beside, the Ark. So he was set up, they put the Ark beside Dagon, and somehow Dagon falls down face first, facing in front of the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ark of Yahweh, it's described as right here. And so the next day, they took Dagon and put him back in his place. So maybe this happened by accident. Maybe there was a tremor or something, and Dagon fell down. But when they rose early the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of Yahweh, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold, and only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. Now, so this is something different. So the first time he falls down in a position of worship after they had set the Ark beside Dagon. So why do we care about this, right? So what is going on here? First of all, it's clear that even though the Philistines try to set up the Ark of the Covenant, who they would assume in some way Yahweh is present with the Ark of the Covenant, as another god for them, the Lord won't settle for that, even with the Ark, which he really isn't in, or he isn't the Ark, and he isn't in the Ark, but he still won't settle for that. He won't have another god beside him. So we, you know, our tendency in this country, in our culture, isn't necessarily that we're going to set up the Lord next to another god, even in our minds. Now, we kind of do, are dangerous to do the opposite of that, and that is to set another up another god up beside the Lord. If you think of, and you just think about our country's principles, we live in a great country with the freedom of worship. Everybody's got the freedom to worship as they want to. And so what is happening in our here is, as we accept that and everybody buys into that freedom to worship, we are equating, because we also believe that all people are created equal, and therefore it kind of leads to everybody's ideas are just as good as anybody else's. As Christians, we can't participate in bringing or allowing or setting alongside of our God other gods. And one of the big things that goes on in our country right now is we say, well, as Christians and Jews and Muslims, we all really worship the same God. I mean, it's the God of Abraham that we worship. And even beyond that, well, are we really so arrogant to think that there's only one way, that it's only one way that our God that Jesus is really the only way? I mean, what about people all over the world? I mean, isn't there just one true God anyway? And so don't people just worship that God in the same way or in different ways, but it's all really, really God? And so what we're doing is actually setting up gods that we create in our own head next to the one true God. And even more so, faith is a personal thing, but in our society we do this. Well, anybody wants to talk about faith or talk about religion, well, that's a personal matter. Let's not talk about that. Let's keep that to ourselves. Let's be private about that. And so what happens is we still, again, create. If it's a personal faith, anybody can create anything in their own mind. They can create God in whatever image they want, because how many times have you heard a phrase like this? Well, the God I know would never condemn somebody for being who God made them and practicing sexuality the way that God made them. What that's doing is setting up another God who isn't God next to our God. And that's more of our danger. We're not ever going to take and think that we're going to set up our God next to an idol somewhere. But we do the opposite of that. We set up in our society gods next to the Christian God, the one true God, the one who we are to ascribe glory to. So back to our text. So the second time Dagon falls down, his head and his hands fall off, or really the palms of his hands, which probably just means the lower part of his hands here. Hands kind of extended a little bit farther up in the Hebrew word for hand. Could have come up partway up your arm. But why do his hands fall off, and why does his head fall off? First of all, he's no match for, and this is a position now of defeat and not just a position of worship. So the idea now is that Dagon has been defeated by the Lord, and his hands, well, as we follow through this, I'll just emphasize a few things here as we go through. And you'll see why his hands were cut off lying on the threshold. So, verse 5, this is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. So that would have been whenever this was written. They don't step on this because their god, Dagon, broke down or was broken in front of of the Lord's ark. Verse 6, and the hand of Yahweh was heavy against the people of Ashdod. Now you can kind of see why the idea that his hands of Dagon fell off, because the imagery here is that we're using here is that the hand of Yahweh was heavy. So things were, he made life difficult for them in Ashdod, the Philistine city, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors. Now, it's not clear exactly. There's some variations in the text, the Hebrew text here, and also between the Hebrew text and the Greek translation that was made before the time of Christ. So there's a little bit of discussion about what this is, what this means that he afflicted them with tumors. It could be something like things that swell up, okay? Another possibility is that it could be, it's thought that maybe it could be hemorrhoids. Another thing is gland swelling because of the bubonic plague. So we'll see that a little bit farther down, why that might be. Boils. It's just not really clear exactly what these tumors were, but they're apparently something that mounds up. You get some kind of a lump of some kind, both in Ashdod and in its territory. So the people in the city and the people outside of the city, each walled city would have a territory around it that belonged to it for pasture and for raising crops and things like that. So Ashdod and its territory, the people were afflicted with these tumors of some kind. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not stay with us, for his hand is hard." That's that same word for that's used for glory. Okay, so his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God. So not only is the ark, they see the ark as the source of this problem that they have, that God, because of the ark, is afflicting them. Our God, the God of Israel, is afflicting them because his hand is against not only them, but also about their God. So they recognize now, and they think the solution here is, so what we need to do, let's call all the Philistine leaders together, verse 8, and say, what shall we do with the Ark of God? Okay, so there are five main cities of the Philistines, and there's one king or ruler in each of those cities, and they get all five of them together. And they answered, let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath, which is east of where they are in Ashdod, and it's getting closer then back to Israel and closer to Jerusalem. So the question is, what does it mean to be brought around to Gath, okay, or Gath? Remember, there are five Philistine cities. Just keep that in your mind. What does it mean to be brought around to Gath? And we'll talk about it a little bit later. So they brought the Ark of God, of the God of Israel, there. So they take it to this other Philistine city, moving away from Ashdod, but so to get rid of these plagues. But who knows why they thought this was a good idea? But after they had brought it around, okay, after they'd brought it around somewhere, the hand of Yahweh was against the city. So now the hand of Yahweh is against Gath, okay, when the ark goes there, causing a very great panic. So it's it intensifies from what happened in Ashdod. And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors, same idea here, broke out on them. And so things got worse. It caused a great panic there. So next, they sent the ark of God to Ekron, a third Philistine city, farther east again, so moving it back toward where the Israelites were. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, so they've heard what goes on. They've brought around to us the ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people. So, okay, they figured out that this isn't a good idea. They don't necessarily want to have this ark in their town. And so the purpose must be that this ark has some kind of deadly force that it can cause disease and suffering and pain and maybe death, because they think it's to kill them. And they sent therefore and gathered together the lords of the Philistines and said, so they brought these five back together again from each of the cities, one from each of the cities, send away the ark of God, of the God of Israel, and let it return to its own place. So they want to send it back to Israel. So whatever they've gotten themselves into with this ark of Yahweh, it didn't turn out like they thought to help them conquer. They want to get this thing out of their territory so that it doesn't afflict them anymore. And the ark isn't doing what they expected it to do. For there was a deathly panic, so it went from very great panic in the last city to deathly panic here throughout the whole city, and the hand of God was very heavy there. So again, that's that same word, that heavy is that same word for glory. Where's the glory? Where's the heaviness? The men who did not die were struck with tumors. So they were dying. Okay, now we've got to the third city. They're dying. The people of this city, the people of Ekron, are dying. And the hand of God was very heavy there. If they didn't die, they got tumors. And the cry for help of the city went up to heaven. And so they're crying for help. They're not just crying in pain. They're crying, somebody save us, essentially, from this great problem that they have with the ark. Chapter 6, then the ark of Yahweh was in the country of the Philistines for 7 months. So it's only been 7 months. They passed it to three cities, and the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners. So they're giving up on the idea of just asking the rulers. Now they're going to turn to their priests and those who can tell them things, tell them the future, tell them things that are hidden from them. And they said, what shall we do with the ark of Yahweh? Tell us with what we shall send it to its place. So they're going to send it back, and they want to know what they should send along with it. So they're asking the priests, since this is some kind of a religious matter, what should we send along with that when we send it back? And they said, if you send away the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it empty. By all means, return him or return it a guilt offering. So it's time for them to return some kind of compensation or some kind of offering for taking the ark in the first place, and that they've now figured out that they shouldn't have done, and so they need to send it back. Then you will be healed. So the priests and the diviners say, if you do this, we as the Philistines will be healed. and it will be known to you why his hand does not turn away from you. So you will understand not only if you do these things, you send back this guilt offering, not only will you get better, but you'll know why it happened. Okay, so you'll know why all these bad things happen. And then they said, "What?" So this is the diviners and the priests. They're talking to the diviners and the priests. What is the guilt offering that we shall return to him? So what are we going to send back? So now we get a section that we wouldn't be familiar with because we haven't been, we certainly haven't been raised in this tradition, and even if we understand offerings, it comes from our understanding of the Old Testament and sacrifices there. So these are the Philistines. They answered, "Here's what you send back, 5 golden tumors." So symbols of the affliction that the people have, and 5 golden mice. Okay, so where did the mice come from all of a sudden? This is debated on what this actually means. So is it that they're supposed to send 10 things then? So 10 things, images of tumors. You can see why it would be 5, one for each city, right? 5 golden mice. One of the other possibilities that was these themes of 1 Samuel that I have up here come from Sumura, and I've used him before, and he thinks that this means this. And it is certainly possible. 5 golden tumors, which are 5 golden mice. So in other words, the tumors are in the shape of a mouse almost. And so when they're sending the tumors, they're really only sending 5 things. Now, that's certainly not everybody's opinion because there's some evidence in the text, both in the some parts of Hebrew text and also in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation I mentioned earlier, that mice are involved here somehow. And that's also where the idea of the bubonic plague comes from, because the bubonic plague is spread by rats and mice. And so the thought is that maybe that they are the cause of this, these great plagues, somehow indirectly, but they do still understand that these came from somehow the idea that they had the ark. So it either means something like 5 golden tumors along with 5 golden mice, or 5 golden tumors, which are 5 golden mice, or which namely 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For the same plague was on all of you and all your lords. So now we see something a little bit more. So a couple of things here to think about. So we've been through 3 of the Philistine cities. And when the ark comes into those cities, that's when the people start getting afflicted with the plague, with the tumors. Well, it says here that all 5 of them have the same problem, the same plague, the same affliction. All 5 of the cities have this. And so there are a couple of possibilities. One is that the text here is letting us know, okay, it's not really the presence of the ark in that city that's causing the tumors, or the ark doesn't, it might be the ark's presence, but it doesn't have to be in that city to cause the tumors, to cause the affliction. In other words, Yahweh is not contained in that ark. He is able to operate wherever he wants to in this Philistine territory, and he does act however he wants to in this Philistine territory because he's sovereign. And so the ark, while it may be a scapegoat or something like that, that the Philistines can blame it on, it's not actually the ark that's the problem here. Okay? It is actually now that the Lord of, that the God of Israel is sovereign against Dagon, whether or not he's in his temple and whether or not he's in one of his cities, he is just everywhere on the Philistines at this time. So that's one of the possibilities. And certainly the other cities are skipped for some reason. Either it just happened, they move basically directly from the coast, from the Mediterranean, a little bit closer to Israel, now a little bit closer to Israel, so they're getting within a few miles of the territory of Israel, I should say, within the territory of Israel, just a few miles away. Or the other thing is, the other possibility is that back in the second city, it said they brought the ark around to Gath. So maybe they brought it to the other cities and they're just left out. The other two cities first before they brought it to Gath and it ended up at Gath. So there's some reason that it says go around. And that wouldn't have been a circular motion, but it would have been out of the way to go to the other Philistine cities to get to Gath. So one of those two things, I think it makes perfect sense that the text is leaving those out to let us know that that God, the ark doesn't have to be somewhere for the Lord to be in control of the situation. So it's not necessarily the ark that is causing all of these things. Verse 5. So we're going to go on and explain what the priests are going to go on and explain, the priests and diviners, what they need to do. More instructions before you send the ark back. So you must make images of your tumors and the images of your mice that ravage the land. Okay, so that's where this, variations on what that says, and give glory to the God of Israel, and perhaps he will lighten his hand from off you and your gods and your land. So they have recognized now that they don't even call it the ark here. Notice they don't say give, they don't say pay attention, they say to the ark, they say give glory to the God of Israel. So the Philistines are to give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from off you and your gods and your land. So they at least get some kind of an idea that the God of Israel now is, that they should pay tribute to him or honor him. Why should you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? So they understand, remember, they understand what happened in Egypt. Okay, so the Philistines are at least awake enough not to become like the Egyptians and completely harden their hearts. They are awake enough to say, don't do that. Don't harden your hearts. Why would you want to do that? Remember what happened in Egypt. After he dealt severely with them, in the last part of verse 6, Did they not send the people away and they departed? So that's what happened in Egypt. Now then, so here's how we're going to find out if it was really the Lord who caused these problems, the God of Israel, as they would say, who caused these problems, or if it was some other reason that we got these sicknesses. So here's what we're going to do. Verse 7. Now then, take and prepare a new cart and two milk cows on which there has never come a yoke. So a couple of important things here for us to realize. Any farmers here? Okay. Some people come from farms. So a milk cow has probably recently given birth, and then we artificially keep them in that state for a long time in this country, right? Or in the world now, in civilization. But anyway, they're producing milk, and so at this time they would have had young, they probably would have had calves, right? Until they're grown up enough to stop drinking milk. And which there has never come a yoke. So they're untrained. Okay, they're probably young cows with newborn calves, and they've never been trained to have a yoke on them, so to work in pairs, for example, and to go a certain way. So they've never been trained to do that. And yoke the cows to the cart. So attach them to the cart, and take their calves home. Okay, so take them away from them, and then take the ark of the Lord, or take the ark of Yahweh, and place it in the cart, and put in it a box at its side with the gold figures. So those are the mice and the tumors, or the mice, which are the tumors, which you are returning to him as a guilt offering, and then send it off, so send the ark off, right? And let it go its way. So let the ark go. So even though it's attached to the cows, what they're saying is that we're going to let the ark go where it wants to. Right? So their understanding would be this ark is going to decide which way the cows go. So then watch, verse 9. So and keep an eye on this, and let's see what happens. And if it goes up on the way to its own land. So that means now, if the ark decides to go back to its own land, which would have been Israel, right, to Beth Shemesh, or which would mean like house of the sun. So they've adapted, they've got a name of a place here that was pre-Israel. So it would have been the name of the place before the Israelites came, because it would have meant house of the sun, which would have been a place to worship the sun. But it's in Israel's territory now. So if it goes on its way to its own land, to Beth Shemesh, would have been probably the closest town to Ekron that was in Israel. So right along the border of Israel and the Philistines' territory. Then, so if that happens, if it goes to Beth Shemesh, then it is he who has done, or it is it who has done us this great harm. So it's either that it's Yahweh or it's the ark, but if it goes that way, if the ark goes back to its own land, because again, their idea would have been that gods have certain areas that they're responsible for or that they rule, and so if this ark goes back to its own land, then you know that it is he or it is the ark, one of the other. It is either Yahweh or it is his ark that has done us this great harm. But if not, then we shall know that it is not his hand, which gives you the idea that, okay, it must mean Yahweh's hand that struck us, and it happened to us by luck or by coincidence or by it just was happenstance. So if the ark doesn't just, with these two cows on it, doesn't just go right back to Beth Shemesh, you'll know that it was just luck. Nothing really had to do with any god. All these things, all these tumors, the death, has all happened by accident. And so the men did so, and took the two cows and yoked them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they put the ark of Yahweh on the cart, and the box with the golden mice and the images of their tumors, and the cows went straight in the direction of Beth Shemesh, along one highway, lowing as they went. They turned neither to the right nor to the left, and the lords of the Philistines went after them as far as the border of Beth Shemesh. So they followed them, and they just went straight there. Okay? So they're understanding that the Philistines were now to understand that, yes, it was the hand of Yahweh, the hand of the God of Israel, that was causing them their troubles. So All should be good now, right? The ark is back in Israel's territory in Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. So you can find this area now. This is it is west of Jerusalem a ways, not far by, well, it doesn't take you long to get there by car. There's this big, huge valley there. It is almost like Richard's last name, but there's no I in it. It's Sorek, okay? And it's there now, and you can find it. You can find these places now in Israel. And when they lifted up their eyes and saw the ark, they rejoiced to see it. So these are now Israelites. They're back in Israel. But here's the current situation in Israel. You're familiar, we've talked about the period of the judges before, where everybody's doing what is right in their own eyes. And if you're familiar with the story of Judges, Jim Power taught on Judges a few years ago. But what happens is Israel goes their own way. They start worshiping other gods. And then one of the judges comes back, rescues them. They pray to the Lord. They come back and they're saved for a while. And then on the next verse or two, and they follow their own way again. They start worshiping other gods. And so God delivers them over to somebody else. The Philistines is one of those. And so this is a time, remember what the priests were like, what this was like before the ark was captured, which was only a few months ago. Right? So the Philistines send him back only a few months ago. And the situation is not good in Israel. Right? They're not following after the Lord. So now that the ark is back in Israel, doesn't necessarily mean good things for the people when it comes back. So just like it was a problem for the Philistines to have the ark, now let's see what happens when it gets to Beth Shemesh. The ark came into the field of Joshua, this is verse 14, of Beth Shemesh, and it stopped there. So, and notice that the cart came. So the cart comes and it stops there, and a great stone was there. And they split up the wood of the cart. Okay, so this is what the Israelites do. They take the wood of the cart, and they offer the cows up as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the Levites took down the ark of Yahweh and the box that was beside it, in which were the golden figures, so the mice and the tumors. And they set them on the great stone. So they put the things that the Philistines thought were a good idea to send as a guilt offering. And it looks like Israelites at this time didn't know what to do with them. So they put them on the great stone, which was probably the thing that they offered sacrifices on. Okay. And the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices on that day to Yahweh. And when the five lords of the Philistines saw it, so they were watching from a distance, they returned that day to Ekron. These are the golden tumors that the Philistines returned as a guilt offering to Yahweh. So now the author is going to explain what these two tumors meant. But notice it only lists them, it doesn't list the mice, which is an argument that there was just one group. But then it does go on to later list the mice separately. One for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ashkelon, one for Gath, and one for Ekron, and the golden mice, which again, Samura would argue, which are the golden mice, according to the number of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and unwalled villages, and the great stone beside which they set down the ark of the Lord is a witness to this day. So when this was written, in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. So they have now they've now made a sacrifice. And then verse 19, and he struck some of the men of Beth Shemesh because they looked upon, or I think it's NIV. Who has NIV? Looked into, right? Is it NIV that has that? Looked into the Ark of Yahweh. Either one would be a good translation. Looked upon or looked into the Ark of Yahweh. So the one looked into is probably the basis for Indiana Jones, those German guys that looked into the Ark and get their face gets, you know, burned off, like a chemical burn off their face. So anyway, looked into the Ark of Yahweh, and he struck 70 men of them. And the people mourned because Yahweh had struck the people with a great blow. Okay, so is there anybody in verse 19 that has something that says something besides 70 men? What do you have? 50,070, right? Okay, so there's a huge debate about this because because the text has something like this. It says 70,000 or 70 men, and then so I'm translating as close to word for word as I can. 70,000 or 70 men, 50 thousands. 50s thousand or 50,000. So, and it doesn't say and. So normally if you get a number, it would say 150, right? Or 50 and 100. It doesn't do that here in Hebrew. It says 70 men, 50 or fives, thousand. So men. So where the problem is that Beth Shemesh wouldn't have had that many people in it. Okay, so one of the explanations is that it means this. 70 men, which is 5 out of every 1,000 that were there. So 14,000 people living in the area, 70 of them, 5 out of every 1,000. It's just not clear exactly what it means. Or it could mean, the way it was written, 50s of every 1,000 as well. So maybe 1,400 people were there, those would make more sense, but you just don't really know. And so most of what happens in the English version is we say, this doesn't make any sense. Let's just take out the 50,000 and make it 70. So 70 people. If you just have 70 people, that's what the translators have done. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's another possibility. That's 50,000 from everywhere, but it would have been hard for them to look upon the ark. You know that we're at this point, so to look upon or look into the ark, that there are 50,000 more people somewhere else that died. Right. Well, okay, so the question was then, have you ever heard the opinion that it was 50,000 and 50,000 basically from among the Philistines then and 70,000 from Israel? I haven't seen that anywhere, but people have struggled to try to figure out what this means anyway. I don't think there's any clear consensus on what the 50,000 means there. So the reaction is, then the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before Yahweh, this holy God, and to whom shall he go up away from us? So in other words, they actually want him to go away. They want, nobody can stand against Yahweh, so where can he go now? Which would be away from us. So these are the people of Israel now saying, nobody can stand before Yahweh. Notice they don't say the ark, though. Nobody can stand before Yahweh, this holy God, and to whom shall he go up away from us? And so they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kiriath Jearim, which would be farther into Israel now and closer to Shiloh, but not all the way there, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of Yahweh. Come down and take it up to you. So come and get it. We don't want it here either. And this section actually goes on for at least one more verse, so we'll get into the first part of chapter 7. And the men of Kiriath Jearim came and took up the ark of the Lord, or the ark of Yahweh. So now the ark is moved farther into Israel, not all the way to Shiloh, but in a place that's well within Israel, and brought it to the house of Abinadab on a hill. Abinadab's probably a Levite, just because of the name. And they consecrated his son Eleazar to have charge over the ark of Yahweh. So from that day that the ark was lodged at Kiriath Jearim, a long time passed. So it's there for a long time, 20 years. And then this phrase at the end of, or this clause at the end of verse 2, that is good news. And all the house of Israel lamented after the Lord, or lamented after Yahweh. So this is, we're still in the period of the judges. Remember, Eli was a judge. Samuel has kind of taken over a prophet role here in Israel, and this recurring cycle of Israel goes into sin, they repent, the Lord comes to the rescue for them, and here at the end of verse 2 in 1 Samuel 7, we hear this, that all the house of Israel, or so the whole nation now, is lamenting before the Lord. So 20 years later, after this return of the ark, the people now start, we're going to jump ahead 20 years, to start to lament to the Lord, or after the Lord. Okay, it is time to end. So we'll pick up in chapter 7 next time. Yes? So the question was, is this a duplication of Israel? The one thing we do have to be careful about regarding that is that we're not Israel. The United States isn't Israel.
Do we know who Israel is? Because we may have people here who really don't even know their backgrounds.
Right. But I just want to be careful about equating any political enemy with the people of God right now. I'm not saying remember what Jesus says about natural disasters and things that look like natural disasters or buildings falling on people is, do you think that these people are worse sinners than other people? And the answer there is no. But be careful lest something worse happens to you. So, yes. Right.
This on the radio. It's not my total. I mean, I didn't hear what I just said. But in Illinois, pastors have come in and
I would agree on this point. As Christians, I do not think we should participate in prayers with other people who are worshiping other gods. I do not think we should participate. However, I do want to make the point that the United States is not a Christian nation. This is not, it is not, we have a lot of Christians in the country, but the political entity of the United States is not Christian. It may have been founded on Judeo-Christian principles, et cetera, but it's not Christian. Yeah.